Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. Can you hear the rain falling? I'm in some kind of, what do all people call these things? Like those glass houses you have on the side of your house. What are they called? Anyway, I really think, am I either having early onset dementia? No, I keep mentioning this, but I keep having like real trouble remembering things like Elizabeth Taylor. I was trying to remember Elizabeth Taylor's name the other day, but now it just came to me just like that. I used to have this problem. Sorry, I've gone straight into rambling. I should have a little bit of an introduction first. I've always had a real problem with remembering words, and I used to think a good example if you have trouble with there's some sort of fancy name for this. It's like dyslexia. Like it's a stupid name that. It's a name that no one would ever remember about a thing where people can't remember things. So I always have to like associate a different word. So the word hypocrite, I find that a really hard word to remember. But I can remember a hip. So when I go into my brain and I go to find the word hypocrite, in the area where that word should be, there's just a big picture of a hip. And for some reason, I always think of Stevie Haston as well. I think because originally I was probably using the word hypocrite about Stevie Haston. Hopefully Stevie Haston isn't listening to this because, you know, but at the time I used to think about Stevie Haston was a hypocrite. Anyway, so I do apologise, Stevie. Well, one day I'll tell you why. I don't know why. I don't even know why I thought you were a hypocrite. But most people are hypocrites, aren't they? Hopefully. Look, I think you know, if writing's the war against cliches, then life is a war against hypocrites. And yeah, so so welcome back to the Psychovertical Podcast. So I'm sitting in this glass house, that's a glass elevator, isn't it, the other one? So a little glass thing. What do all people say? People come around and say, oh, do you want to buy a glass thing to live in because you're old? Anyway, I'm in one of those things, and I'm in Galway in Ireland, and I'm cocooned here. That's what they call it, cocooned in Ireland, for house arrest. And I really love the way the language is, like, so interesting how people use it. Like the other day there was an advert on the television, and it was for like stuff that, you know, like lamb or some kind of stuff you get out of a field. And instead of saying the word farmer, they said producer. You know, these are brought to you by producers instead of by farmers. And I wonder if like someone makes a decision, we're going to stop using the word farmer because it's a bit masculine, and we're going to start using the word producer instead. And I think a better way to, I think instead of getting rid of, instead of producers, it just sounds like someone who's got like loads of, you know, like rubber gloves on and like one of those hats stop your hair from falling into stuff, like chopping up things and throwing them in boxes. I think we should start calling farmers landscape stakeholders. So I think that's it's a more inclusive and anyway. So yeah, so I find language like all that kind of stuff is very, increasingly I'm finding it very interesting the way people talk about stuff. Anyway, so I'm cocooned in Galway. Someone asked that these podcasts have been very have not been very talking about the thing everyone else is talking about, and a few people have said that I should do things, that I could do things while the thing is going on. And, you know, I could like, I should like leverage the thing because there's lots of people sitting around doing nothing. But it's probably a failing of mine, but I really don't like sort of exploiting terrible things going on just to, you know, to for my brand or whatever. I just can't bring myself to do it. So, yeah, like I should be doing like loads of podcasts and, you know, singing like Imagine, get like me, Stevie Haston, Conrad Anka, Alex Magos, get us all to Imagine all the people. Yeah, that would be really, really cool, I think. Grimer could do it. Grimer's the kind of person would do stuff like that. I bet he's baking cakes and filming himself. I was going to say the word wanking then, but I won't say that because like kids might be listening to this. And that probably brings us into some of my housekeeping. Someone has contacted me, one of my my many listener, and he said that I was listening to episode 16. I think it's the second time you mentioned masturbating in front of a camera for money. So that's kind of a little bit alarming because I just hope I'm not talking about like crampons and prussic loops on my other podcast. So thanks to Jan Jasset. Is that a real name? Jasset? Anyway, I think people make these names up because I know I do because none of these are real people. I'm just making them up. So yeah, if when you make up imaginary letters from people, it's always really difficult to get the names right. And also, if you're gonna do them and send them into magazines, like you're answering them, if you're really bad at spelling, people can always tell because you spell them wrong. That's why you need a good editor. So I thought today's a higher education episode of this podcast where I'm going to go through a load of inane, kind of boring questions that people have sent me, like how long is a piece of rope and stuff like that. I made that one up, and like loads of stuff, and then I'll read through them, and nothing will make any sense because it's not really good for the radio. But I did, actually today I was having a funny, I've had two funny memories. So this friend of mine, Paul Ramsden, who won the Pile d'Or, I think he's won the Pile d'Or more than anybody else alive, which is not difficult because nearly everyone's dead who's won it. And he is a really good climber. If you met him, you wouldn't think he was a really good climber. He's just like a miserable kind of Yorkshire type person. Like if he was in, do you know, like if you made like a climbing version of Game of Thrones, then someone like Adam Ondra, he would be like one of the main characters, and you know Chris Bonington would be one of the, you know, the old man, you know, in the thing, but Paul Ramsden would probably be a guy in the back of a crowd or something, like maybe a guy with a pike, probably, you know. So he's when you meet him, like, you know, he's an incredible climber, incredible mountaineer, but when you meet him, you won't really realize it. But he's actually a very formative person in my life. I've had lots of crap climbing trips with him, but as a human being, he's very interesting. I don't think he gets any free gear from anybody because he doesn't really tell anybody what he does. He doesn't write books or blog or whatever. He just kind of does his own. He does his own thing. But he is probably one of the people I've met in my life who has probably had one of the more interesting lives. He's done a lot of interesting things. He's actually a health and safety person. So when he used to climb a lot with Mick Fowler, he had like a taxman and a health and safety person going off together. But you know, he seems to end up in like Yemen and all sorts of. It's like a top end, like a James Bond version of a health and safety person. So he's done anyway. So he's taught me a few things. He's got some really good lines. Like one of his lines is, it's like, this is for your business. We might not be good, but we're cheap. That was something I've always kept in mind. But for some reason, well, this week he sent me a message. Like, we don't seem to communicate very much. And he sent me a message about something. I think he wanted to know about abseiling on a thin rope. Like, if, you know, it's about using a really thin rope, using a 9mm lead rope and then like a 5mm, 6mm abseil rope. So I sent him the advanced chapter of my of Down. Don't want to keep talking about Down, but anyway, that's all I think. That's why I'm going senile, because my head is just literally full of stupid knots and prussic loops and friction hitches, I said, and also lanyards. I also realised I have not actually, I've not been talking about lanyards much. I reckon it's because of, you know, because of this whole thing. And I know people keep contacting me, like, when's the lanyard edition coming? And I've decided I might actually make it into like a CD-ROM and just go like totally retro, or a Beta, or put on a Beta cassette tape or something. It's gonna, but it is coming, because, you know, I've been storing up, you know, like basically in Down, there must be a good 50,000 words just on lanyards. That doesn't include those Purcell Prussic things, what we call them. So anyway, so Paul Ramsden contacted me, and I sent him the advanced chapter of this book, and he replied that he thought he knew everything. he prided himself on knowing everything about climbing, but he's realised he doesn't know as much as he thought, because there was all sorts of stuff, probably stuff I'd made up that probably wasn't relevant to what he wanted. But for some reason, two things. First of all, I think I made a joke today about hemorrhoids, about having some tweet about hemorrhoids. I've never had hemorrhoids, but I can imagine what it's probably like giving birth. I can imagine what it's like to have hemorrhoids. I think it's like a genetic thing. But Paul Ramsden told me the story about a friend of his. I think he was in Antarctica. I think he worked for British Antarctic Survey, and there was a guy there who was always telling everybody about his friends at the Brennan. Like Plassey Brennan, if you don't live in the UK, Plassey Brennan is like a, you know, famous outdoor centre. It's full of like hard men, you know, people, you know, instructor types, you know, my fucking miserable, and you know, all these instructor types, and they're all anyway. So this guy was always saying like, "Oh, my friends at the Brennan. Oh yeah, my friends at the Brennan. Oh yeah, my friends at the Brennan." So eventually, everyone got so pissed off with this that they started calling hemorrhoids my friends at the Brennan. So they'd be like, "Oh God, my friends at the Brennan," and "Oh God, it's my friends at the Brennan are bleeding," all that kind of stuff. And I was so when anybody ever mentions hemorrhoids, it always makes me laugh. So having returned from the Middle East, I don't know if I'm going back to the Middle East. I've got to see if we ever go anywhere else again. So I'm not sure what's going on. On with that kind of thing, and I'm kind of missing it. Although it's a total shithole, I am kind of missing it. But Paul said in this email, like, "Oh, going to live in the Middle East, did it change your politics?" And it's the second person this week to mention my politics, and I am one of these people. If you ever look, if anybody ever says, "Oh, you know, oh, Andy Kirkpatrick, I don't agree with everything he says," but, and they always seem to have this kind of thing about my politics, but I don't think I really have any. Like I've said before, I'm politically agnostic, but yes, it made me. I think I might have to try and work out what they. I think probably at the moment, everything that's going on with the thing is only confirming my view of the world and society and everything else. So we shall see. So that's the story about hemorrhoids. I thought I'd get that in at the beginning. Final little bit of housekeeping. Now I was gonna do this as a video and have it on YouTube, because there's a few things I was gonna actually physically manhandle, nothing to do with the wanking stuff. I was going to physically manhandle things and point at things, but I just couldn't be arsed doing it. So I don't know why. I even had my face, all the hair on my face, cut down to a more manageable levels, so you could see my face. But I still not got around to it. Seems a bit of. I think you kind of have to have a bit of a studio thing. Like I'm definitely. Going into the world of YouTube, and recently my kids have got no future anymore, so I'm you know, it's mainly for them I'm doing it. But I think if I'm going to do it properly, you know, I want to have like a massive studio. I want to be like Joe Rogan, but like a climbing version of Joe Rogan, but with no guests, and just, you know, just like a shit version of Joe Rogan with no guests and just carabiners and knots instead. So like, you do end up with this kind of weird relationship, because I have a mental block about pulley systems and 1 to 2s and 3 to 4s and 16s to whatever, and I always get it wrong. So whenever I do a diagram, and I think the diagram in one of my books is wrong, but whenever I do a diagram, I like stick it up on Instagram or something, and immediately it's like, oh, that's not a 2 to 1, that's a 17 to 1 or something, and I'm like, oh god. And it's very, very, I find it very annoying, really, because it's not like I don't understand how it works. It's not like I haven't done it. Like, I've hauled like an unbelievable amount of shit around up big walls and stuff, you know, like, you know, just crazy amounts of weight and everything else. But I just have a problem with like knowing what it's called and how it, like I only found out what a square number was like this year. So give me a break. So yeah. So whenever I'm like, oh, I've got this wrong, this thing, like a lot of problems is you know what something is and you've used it and you know it works, but you don't know what it's called. So you end up having to go on YouTube. So I would say, like, if you're setting up, this week I was writing a bit in the book about, so it's all about abseiling basically. And in the, there's a chapter called, what's it called? It's called problem solving. And in that, it's got like, you know, ropes are stuck, all that kind of, all those rope stuck kind of things, which are the main problems. But then it's got like a section on like, if the ropes don't reach the anchor, you know, your rope's too short or whatever, and all this kind of stuff. And, but there's quite a few things where I know what they are, and I've done it myself. I don't really know what you'd call it. So, Pete Whittaker, have anybody listened to Pete Whittaker interview I did with him on this podcast? You know, he was saying how to make all these names up, which is you know, it's kind of funny. I think he had ones like called riding the donkey, or you know tickling the squirrel and all this kind of stuff. But it's quite hard to come up with a really fun, you know, integrated bowline. So it's not quite the same. You can't really come up with, you know, zigzag carabiner break, you know. It's like, it's not that exciting, so. What was my point? So I was going, in this chapter about problem solving. I've got a bit, like, if someone's hanging on a rope, generally if someone's hanging on a rope and you have to haul them up, you know, it's always like on a, if you're in a crevasse or, you know, that kind of story. But it's actually quite difficult when you're abseiling, because basically, the person is out on the end, down there on the rope somewhere, and you have no rope apart from the tails at your end, and you have to somehow kind of haul them back up again, which is actually quite a good get out of that kind of problem. And in the diagram, in the description, I just talk about setting up a separate haul system, haul line, like a hauling, so piggyback. I call it like a piggyback haul, where you use a separate piece of cord from the actual ropes. So you're not using the ropes to haul, because you know the ropes are thinner, so they have less friction on them, and they're also sort of semi-static, where, you know, if you're hauling on climbing ropes, they're more stretchy and all that kind of stuff. So, but it's very hard to come up with any name, so you end up like going on YouTube and like trawling through all these videos trying to work out what something's called, and you'll see, you know, people will call, there's like 20 names for everything. And as soon as you call it one thing, someone's like, oh, in tree surgeons call it, you know, stick up your ass pulley system or something. And you're like, oh Christ, everyone's got a bloody opinion. So yeah, I'm out of a big thing at the beginning of the book, like, everything in this book is wrong. Let's take it as read, everything in this book is wrong. But if you can find something that makes, you know, that's useful, then so be it. But you do have to get stuff right. That's the problem, because once it's printed, it's out there. Like this book, I really feel like it's going to become like the book people buy. Like when I was started climbing, it was probably Nigel Shepherd's Modern Rope Techniques, which is like the book everyone seemed to have. And I think this will be like one of those kind of books, although I think it's probably going to end up being a lot bigger than that book. But so it has to be, you know, like I'm not like, who's that? Who was the person who wrote that? Is it not Langmuir? What's those Freedom of the Hills? You know, all those books that, you know, when you're doing your, when people have qualifications and this kind of thing, they have to buy these books and they have to read them and like, oh yes, yes, it's 15 paces, you know, or, you know, it's like really, oh Christ, you know, I just can't, I'm not, yes, you shouldn't lark's foot, that's highly dangerous. You know, it's like you're reading something from 1952, you know, like, yes, you should never belay with a ventile anorak. I have this thing called a Murphy sling, which is like a way of like backing up an anchor, like an abseil anchor, where you just, each pair just does a lark's foot into it with a sling. And everyone who's seen it's like, oh, you can't do that. You can't lark's foot into a sling. It's like really, really dangerous. And it's like, no, actually, it's actually okay now. After 40 years being told not to do it, it turns out it's okay. So we just got it wrong. And so I'll have lots of stuff like that. So people like, either it's like cutting edge and people don't know it's right, or it is wrong and it'll kill somebody. So that's the problem with trying to get the balance between the two. So watching all these videos, you realize you end up with these, you know, is it Mike Barter? I can't remember his name now. I've met him in Canada, but you know, there's all these people on YouTube who do these videos that you've watched them so many times. That guy who does like the, there's a guy who's like some kind of, you know, he looks like he's probably owns an M16 and, you know, builds his own cars and stuff. And he's like doing, you know, these like things with like pulleys and stuff. And this is a 2-to-1, this is a 5-to-1 and all that kind of stuff. But you watch it so many times, you really feel like you're having a relationship with this person. And, you know, when you first started watching it, there was only, you know, there's like 50 views. And now you go back and it's like 5 million views. So it's amazing how when something's out there for such a long time, how it becomes, you know, it just becomes like really famous. It's like Spinal Tap or something. It's like something everyone's seen it. So especially at the moment, like everyone is watching the most like obscure stuff. And so yeah, it's kind of interesting. So anyway, so let's crack on with these questions that people have been sending me. But if you want to, so I think I've got, how many, let's have a look. I've got my computer open here. How many, where's my thing? Your videos. Where's my channel? God, there's another question. First off, risk of sounding like a punter. Yeah, I'm going to read that one out. I love it when people say, like, start the sentence, like, you know, oh my God, oh my God, oh God, it's me talking. How many, this is not very professional. I really need to have some notes and know what I'm going to say. Oh God. So I got 1,650, is that right? 1,650 followers. So anyway, so if I can get that up to 2,000, then this is me now exploiting the thing. Just go and just click it. Like, never go and watching these films, it'd be shit. But basically, it just helps me to be asked to do this kind of, to get on with it, really, because I'll feel like someone's going to be watching it. We'll start with this question. This is like totally live. This is live. Oh God, it's quite long. This is like I'm going to read this question, this live question. I hope it doesn't go into something weird or anything. I better miss that bit out. No, I'll read it. What the hair? So, hey Andy. First off, at the risk of sounding like a punter, in brackets, I'm Canadian. You're welcome. I wanted to give you a true thanks for all the content you've shared. You're welcome. From books, films, podcasts, and random posts. This sounds like the type of thing I've actually written to myself here. I would love to follow you on your YouTube channel. Where can I find a link to it? Thank you very much. Your stories of heart, Don Juan sort of way. Don Juan, is he some kind of porn star? I don't know. and the raw style of your films and edited, blah, blah, blah. I don't want it to talk about me. Very much prefer. I have learned more useful things from your blog's techniques archive than I could from any climbing technique book ever released. Well, I hope that's not true because I've released some quite good books. That was until Higher Education came out. And for that, I will give you the biggest thanks. You're welcome. It was very expensive, so you're welcome twice. My climbing partner and I, with no true aid climbing or big wall experience, have brought the book, and without even practicing together, just corresponding online, that's where they do it. He lives in a different continent, fair enough, America, showing up in Yosemite, and we were successful on our first walls, the west face of Leaning Tower, easy, then Zodiac, a little bit harder, without bailing, and undoubtedly with far less flailing around than if we were up there figuring it out for hours without your hardware and one lessons. Looking forward to down, but unlike all the others probably hurrying you, you should take your sweet time. I am. But it's not sweet. It's like a nightmare. So now to the question. So I hope you're feeling this. This is like edgy stuff, isn't it? Like I'm really, this is like a live yet recorded, you know, live action answering questions, Q&A. All right, enough spraying of gratitudes. My question is simply, if you're considering to do a Zoom slideshow, on a climb or expedition that you haven't written too much about, would be very cool to see and hear more detail on how to choose the objective, the travel, the gear, technical climbing, and the place's walls. I have no doubt that this would be a pain in the ass, yes, to set up, yes, but I know the right now there's a ton of people could just use some inspiration, and maybe you could do one instead of a 2 week anyway, just an idea that I thought of after watching a few of Steve House's live slideshow stories, where I was thinking, yes, I will, blah, 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 blah. So, Steve House, he has been doing some good Zoom things. I don't know if they must be on YouTube, maybe. And I think I kind of came into one, and he was a little bit like, where is everybody? I've done it myself. When you do things, when you do like quick Q&A or do something like live, and there's like nobody there. You know, like I am 12. What is this? You know, like there's no one there. And he's like, oh, this is pointless. But Steve's thing is like dead good. It's like him just like talking about his expedition, all the little tiny stuff you can never really do in a normal slideshow because you haven't got much time to do all. It's all the little nitty gritty things that are always really interested, like what kind of rice you buy in a market and all that kind of stuff. Final bit of this email, and last, just wanted to share this. Oh, anyone? So he wants to share a film with me about some guy in Cerro Torre. That's good. So it wasn't really a question. Yeah. So anyway, no, I'm not gonna do that. yeah, maybe I will, because I've not really talked about. I've not actually talked that much about going to Denali last year. Although we're on Denali in February for about eight weeks or something, I haven't really talked about it or written anything about it. So maybe that might be an interesting thing to do. Maybe I'll get Vanessa. Maybe Vanessa will do a Zoom together, because she's, you know, she isn't really a mountaineer. So to be up on Denali was kind of interesting. As an aside, actually, see if I can find this email, because I'm gonna what do you call it when you like really like shit on someone? Roasting someone? Anyway, I can't find it. But anyways, I did have this thing where I wanted to write about it. I had this idea about writing an article. I'm trying to find it because it's quite funny. I've got a short temper. Maybe, but it doesn't manifest itself as in like going like violence or being whatever. Oh, is it there? Yeah, sorry. I'll just edit this bit out because it's I'm trying to remember someone's name. but I can't remember his name, so I'm trying to find his email. Oh, yeah, here it is. Oh, yeah. So, so this is an email to the editor of a famous magazine. So I basically wrote him saying hi, you know me, you know, I've written, you know, hi, living in the Gulf at the moment, waiting for the bombs to drop. It was during when the Iran thing was going on, but I was thinking it would be fun to write something for a magazine about trying to climb Denali in winter with my wife, who had only climbed Mont Blanc before. We got up to Camp 5, but turned around after we ran out of food and she got CO, carbon monoxide poisoning. Blah, 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 blah. Going up there in winter with a novice might sound stupid, but the ranger said it was pretty much the perfect trip. Well, apart from not getting to the top, thought it might be an interesting read, blah, blah, blah. So I thought they might be interested in it because, I kind of written a lot of stuff. You know, award-winning writer, you know, all this kind of stuff. I'm not an idiot. Like, I'm not going to write something, you know, I'm going to write something, hopefully write something interesting about it. And it's not going to be the typical, you know, typical climbing-related thing. But basically, I can't find his answer. His answer was, I can't find it. Oh, sorry. But basically, his answer was that they didn't want to publish something which might be construed as someone taking his girlfriend up Denali in the wintertime, and that he was a real hero and she was like a novice, because it would play to like gender stereotypes, and basically, no, we don't want to. You know, we don't want to do it because we're afraid of, you know, the backlash of writing something like that. So, I basically said, you need to give up your job as an editor. I won't read what I wrote to him, but I just totally went crazy at him. So, I think he said calm down. I think he actually, his reply was calm down, geez, Andy, take a pill. I just find that kind of thing, you know, I just find that kind of thing crazy. Because the thing is, what I was going to write was, it was in no way making me out to be a hero. It was to make me out to be a fucking complete imbecile. And my wife being the complete hero who was super tough and super able. It would have been a really great piece of writing that made, you know, if you're at the moment, you hear so many stuff where editors are and publishers are we need more writing by women. And basically we'll publish anything no matter how shit it is because we just need something. And the same with events. We have these five mountaineers doing this thing, but they're all men. We need some women, but we can't find any women who will do it or are available to do it. For me, it's an opportunity for someone to write something about a woman doing something that's super hardcore and her being super on it and super capable. But instead, it's nothing. It doesn't get written because, you know, I don't even wanted to get paid for it. I just thought it'd be interesting to write something like that for a magazine again, because I don't really write for magazines. And yeah, it just made me so pissed off, because it's this lowest common denominator. It just assumes I'm just gonna write this puff piece about myself, which is not what I do really. And it made me think at the time, I just need to start my own magazine. But luckily, I got over that. So maybe we will do a Zoom kind of thing about maybe that trip or some other, some trips, my trip to Antarctica is a textbook thing about team dynamics and how bad they can go, and having to sort of try and, you know, deal with all sorts of stuff going on with people. But sometimes you just can't talk about these things until everyone's died. So I'll have to save that one. Hopefully I'm the last man standing. But like every trip you do, always has some really interesting lessons you can like pass on to other people. In the Down book, there's a chapter on communication, because like communication is really important when you're descending a mountain. It covers all sorts of stuff, like just from the communicating normally between two people when you're absent down a mountain, to also the thing that you should always communicate to each other when something's wrong or when you think something's wrong. You shouldn't just stay quiet. You know, the classic thing is you're not very experienced and you see someone who is experienced doing something really dangerous, like clipping into one rope rather than two ropes at an abseil, and you're like, maybe I should say something, but maybe he obviously knows what he's doing, and then he's like, and he's gone. So the nature of the nature of mountaineering literature and culture, I think, is actually not about the art of it and making money out of it and all that kind of stuff. It's the passing on of information. So my wife is like annoying me. Just fuck off! She's looking through the window at me, trying to annoy me, trying to put me off. So you know, I was just on a good point there as well. And she's like, I was going to start singing, but it's about. You know, it begins with people like in a pub or in the olden days in a pub, and people will be telling all these stories about experiences, and you have all these anecdotes, and that's how it kind of started off, really. So you know, I think we probably have less of a culture of that, you know, firsthand. Like now, it's a culture of people, you know, like a million. You have to read through like 50 posts about a knot, and then you'll find some. You know, something really interesting, but you'll get someone who is like Werner Braun, you know, who's like been in charge of like Yosemite Mountain Rescue for 100 years, and he'll say something, and the next person will be like, "You don't know what you're talking about, mate," and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, you have to kind of filter it out. Where in a pub, you used to have a much more there was more of a hierarchy. And I think I'm a really big fan of hierarchy. I don't want to get all like Jordan Peterson on you, but I am a really big fan of hierarchies, and climbing hierarchies are really important. Like you have to know your place, and you want to aspire to be, you know, move up the hierarchy. And you know, you let people who generally the people who people would look up to in the past were generally people with a lot of experience. So when they were, you know, they had more freedom to speak, because what they said probably did have more value. Like there's a really one of my favorite stories of all time is Johnny Dawes, the famous Johnny Dawes. He did this slideshow, and he was talking about fear, and he said, "Has anybody here ever been really, really afraid?" And this guy's like, "Yeah, I have." And he goes like, "Do you want to tell us about it? Do you want to like share your story?" And the guy's like, "Yeah, I will, yeah." He said, "Yeah, I was on this this mal severe," and Johnny's like, "Shut up! You don't know what you're talking about." He just like took the microphone off him. So I shall look into that. Thank you for that message. I thought it was gonna be something more exciting to read out, but never. Next time I do this, everyone send me messages. The more messages you send, the more chances it might arrive when I'm actually doing this. So, dear Andy, love the podcasts, especially the tea breaks. I didn't have any tea today. I have a question that I'm hoping you've got so much crap on my windscreen, on my computer screen. I can't see what the words are. I have a question that I'm hoping you might be able to answer in your podcast. I shall see. I am more of a hiker. Oh God, I'm going to stop reading there. I'm more of a hiker than a climber, so this might be really basic. I'm sure it will be. Apart from crossing a glacier, traversing a narrow ridge where if one person falls, the other can jump down the opposite side, or if anchors are being used, when if ever is it a good idea to be roped up in a team? It just seems to me that it means that if one person falls, that everyone else goes too. Good up Good up the good work. Best regards, Matthew. Now, that is actually a very good question. Now, Matthew, you are a hiker, but that is a good question. The type of question hikers ask and climbers don't. So, being tied to another person. Yeah, that is always a tricky thing. Now, that is one good reason why you want to go climbing. You don't want to go hiking. And like Mick Fowler, one of the best bits of advice any climber is ever going to give another climber. Well, not a climber, an alpinist, which is like a climber who wants to kill themselves, is stick to the buttresses. Now, once you go off the buttresses and you start going up the couloirs and you start going up the other stuff, the easy stuff, that's when it gets really, really dangerous. Because when you're on a buttress, you invariably always have a good belay. You always have some kind of belay, and you generally have gear in between. Now, in all my life climbing, climbing and stuff, I can only think of a very few occasions where I couldn't find a belay, and people, you know, we had to climb together to find something. And I don't think I ever had a belay where I was really like, hey God, if this person falls on this belay, we're gonna die or something. I think, like Mick Fowler, someone told me early on that Mick Fowler was really, really good at finding protection. So, you know, someone probably told me that when I was like 20 or something. So I always thought that that's what I had to get good at, was finding protection. And I have always been very good at finding protection and, you know, sort of hanging out in there and not putting up with like really, really crappy belays. Like on some of the, you know, I've got like photographs when we tried to climb the Russian route on the Eiger, you know, and we've got like belays, you know, that are totally insane. You know, we have, you know, like bird beaks and, you know, all this stuff. You know, you have like this, you know, hugely complicated belay, you know, because you're just not, it's, you know, it's not part of the game is to have a belay that's you're going to die, you know, hauling on. So I would say, you know, if you're a hiker and if you're a climber, just get straight onto the technical stuff. Don't be messing around with, you know, when people say, I'm going to the Alps and I'm going to do like the Gervisutti couloir or something. I'm like, why? Why are you going to do that? Like, don't climb something that people can ski down, basically. It's just pointless, you know, like maybe in the olden days. Like my dad, when he was climbing like in the 60s, he was saying that, you know, things which are now like the descent gully, that would take them like all day to climb it because they'd be like chopping steps up there and all that kind of stuff. You know, once people started using crampons, front pointing more, then, you know, it kind of, the game changed. But there's no reason why anyone should be climbing these routes that haven't got any belays, haven't got any runners in them, you know, unless you're just like kind of incompetent. But then it leads on to the, you know, like mountaineering and the same, like I just can't see mountaineering just seems like so dangerous to me. It just seems like I went to see a slideshow by a guy who was like the first Commonwealth man to climb all the 8,000 meter peaks. It just seemed like fucking insanity, like what he was doing and how many people were dying doing it. And you know, like if you're a guide and you have like clients, then it is actually amazing how much, you know, just like pulling someone at the right moment can actually stop them, you know, from falling off, and that kind of security. But often it's like a false insecurity. Like when I've been climbing with people where you just tie together and there isn't really any gear, like going up a snow slope or something, you know, you often have to just say, like, you do realize, like, if you fall off, you're going to die. You're going to pull me off as well. Like, there's no way I can stop you. And people be like, what, really? Oh, my God, I didn't realize. So there is, the rope can, like, lull you into this false insecurity. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard that saying, like, where there's rope, there's hope. And that is kind of true. Like, if two people are falling down a mountain, there's a lot of spiky things on a mountain. You know, and ropes do seem to have a habit of like catching on them. Like some people like tumble all the way down and you basically get wrapped up in the rope, and that's one of the things that can kill you, is that you're just like sort of crushed and suffocated by your rope. So for me, like climbing with, so say like when I was on say I was on Denali with last year, so we had a rope, and you know, there's one point where I started falling down the mountain because my boots were so big, and I had to do an ice axe arrest. And if I hadn't, I would have just yanked Vanessa off, and I don't think we would have died, but it wouldn't have been a very good outcome, whatever happened. So you know, so that's a good example of why it's a bad idea. But then other times when you're like on Denali, there's like you go up this ridge. And the ridge is like very, very easy, but it's still, you know, like that. I don't know if it's the same in the summertime. In the wintertime, it's like very, very icy. You know, you really are like, you know, you're just using your crampons. You really need like good solid like crampons to get up there. And you know, when you're tied to the other person, you are, you know, most of the time you're trying to find, you know, slings for spikes, and there's lots of like stuff sticking out. There's lots of snow stakes on Denali, so you're like clipping into those. So you're kind of moving together, and it means that you can give assistance to the other person. You know, like all those classic skills that are worth developing on easy stuff like scrambling. You know, like just like you can produce quite a lot of force by just putting the rope around a rock and just, you know, like around a spike and kind of, you know, doing like a direct belay off a spike of rock and various kind of things. So the you know, like the rope is like really, really important in that kind of situation. But you do get to the point where, like Matthew says, you know, when you're on a ridge, you always have this idea that if someone falls, you can just jump off the other side. Like whether you ever did, people have done it, but whether you could do it, I don't know, it's a different thing. But in my experience, when people fall when they're mountaineering, it's not like a climbing fall. It's always like stumbles and trips and that kind of thing. And it begins as like a slow motion fall. So if you're kind of attentive, there is the chance that you could like stop somebody from like sliding down, falling off something. But I think a lot of the times in the mountains, you're having this rope because of crevasses. That's the main kind of reason. But you definitely don't want to be. You basically want to be with someone who is happy, you know, happy to solo. You could solo up there and they'd be fine. You don't want to be tied to someone who isn't sort of confident on the feet and is like stumbling around and everything else. I guess in reverse, it would be a bit like, let's both ski down this couloir, this like steep couloir, and we'll both tie together. Like at what angle couloir you're happy to go down with another person? Like you'd only go down like a steep couloir. Like if you're just going down like a, you know, a black slope or something, that'd be quite scary if you didn't really trust the person. But if you're going down something that's like 40 degrees, then you know, you really have to trust that person that they're not going to fuck up. And even then, there's always a risk they're going to fuck up. So, but generally, the mountains got your attention when you're moving together and you haven't got anything else between you. Like little things, you know, little things like making the most of the terrain, like having some slings if there's a spike sticking up, or zigzagging around, or knowing when to stop. Like even if you don't have a belay, you know, sometimes it's best to stop at a good point, bring the other person up, and then swap over. Like if you're tired, if you're trying to rush, if you're being rushed, like if the person in the front is a lot better than you, then sometimes you can feel like you're being pulled too fast. But also the person that behind is generally getting an easy ride because the other person at the front is kicking steps. Like this leads into the next question here, but you know, like if you're on an ice slope and you're moving together, like say a route like the north face of the Duats or something, or the Lagarde Couloir or something on the Duats. Like the north face of the Duats has got like a, you know, maybe it's like 500 meters of, or maybe longer than that, of sort of 45 degree ice nevis or snow slope thing. And if you're not going to belay together up there, then you're probably best like soloing up that soloing up there, soloing up and have one rope each or just carry one rope. And ideally, the person at the front should always have the rope so they can send it down to the person below. But like on a route like the Gard Couloir or some of the like big couloirs in the Alps, there's always places to play. Like, what, you know, it's technical enough that there is rock around. And yeah, maybe in the past people didn't have as much gear, so they would just, you know, like solo up there tied together with a rope, and every now and again they might make a belay. But if you've got like a good enough rack, then you should be able to always find some kind of belay. Carry a snow stake and not learn how to use a snow stake and various, you know, forms of protection. I'd say, you know, rope is good. Where there's rope, there's hope. And like, if you're not willing to tie on with somebody, then maybe you shouldn't be climbing with that person either. And if it's a catch 22, like if they need a rope, then you shouldn't be climbing with them. But if you don't want to be tied to them, then you shouldn't be climbing with them either. So it's a tricky one, really. But it's not, the thing is about mountaineering and the thing about life, as we are discovering at the moment, is life is full of choices, and sometimes there isn't like a right way to do anything. So you just have to make a judgment call, really, for yourself. Next question. Blah blah blah. I really enjoyed your podcasts. I have a question about climbing steep snow. I had a couple of seasons in the Alps and would like to progress to harder routes. The Frendo, the Migot, Swiss route, etc. However, these all involve climbing steep snow with limited options for protection. Due to the terrain, some of these routes seem impossible to have at least one piece of gear in. Is it just a case of concentrating on your footwork and moving up the pitch unprotected? I have seen recommendations for snow stakes and dead men, although usually anchors, but they seem cumbersome to use as runners. Should I look to get mileage in moving on unprotected snow so I don't freak out on bigger routes? If so, can you recommend any less serious objectives? Many thanks, Liam. So yeah, because this kind of ties into the other question. So Liam here is talking about more technical routes, like the Swiss route on the Corts isn't really technical. Like the North Face of Duats is like, I soloed the North Face of Duats in like 1998 or something, and there's only really, you know, like 20 feet of grade 5 like ice probably on it, and the rest of it is more kind of straightforward, but you are like 1,000 meters off the ground, so if you make a mistake, it's more serious. But I would say, first of all, I don't know if Liam's from the UK or where he lives, but the most important thing about these routes is to do them in condition, because it's probably a little bit like kayaking. So if you go and try and kayak this famous, dangerous, you know, white water rapid kind of thing, you know, the witch's cauldron or something, and you go there in the middle of a drought, like you're not going to go anywhere. You're just going to be sitting in your kayak in a stream bed. If you go there in like a ginormous storm, hellish storm, you know, you're just going to get killed immediately. So it's all about getting the timing. And I think alpinism is really, really about that. Like, if you're going to do more technical routes, so like the Frendo Spur is mainly kind of rock climbing with the Iseret thing at the top, and you can probably wing the Frendo Spur, because lots of people have, but not the Swiss routes on the Corts. Because if you get on a route like that and there's not enough ice and it's just like blank slabs of rock with snow on it, then it's really, really almost impossible to climb. It turns from being like a grade 3, you know, plod with some little tiny steps of steeper stuff, but never very steep, to being like a grade 8 mixed climb. So So it's all about getting the conditions. So you need to get these routes when they have a lot of coverage of ice and neve, not ice, ideally neve, and it needs to go from the top to the bottom. You need a good weather forecast because they're just a giant big funnel of snow and everything else, and you need to keep an eye out, see if other people are climbing these routes, what the conditions are like. Sometimes a route can be, you know, really good at the bottom, and the top can be like really, really horrible, and lots of snow and everything else. If it gets too cold, then if there's ice, the ice can be too brittle. So it's really about keeping an eye on it. Like if you spend any time in the Alps, you'll notice that the good climbers don't really climb very often. They just sort of sit around, you know, they go on the road bikes or whatever. They don't really do it. They go skiing and stuff in the winter time. And then they'll just hear that, like, Beyond Good and Evil's in condition, or, you know, the McIntyre is in condition, and they'll like zoom out there and they'll race up it and it'll be easy. Where if you're like a Brit or someone else, you like rock up there and you'll get on one of these routes out of condition and it'd be a fucking nightmare, and you'll take 10 times as long and you'll nearly die, and it'll be horrendous, and you'll have like stories. I think someone told me a story about doing the courts. I think they had like one ice screw in. I think it wasn't an ice screw. It was actually one of those ice, like an ice peg, like a warthog. And it was only, I think it was in the ice, and that was the belay. And the guy he was with fell off, and he fell onto the belay, and the warthog like bent in half, and then didn't come out of the ice. And that's like saved them. And you know, there's like lots of stories. But like the gear and stuff's improved. Like boots have improved. Crampons are better. But when you're on like a big ice face, you can't really pitch those kind of routes. Like you could, you know, people have pitched like the north face of the Duats, and they'll climb the first bit up to the head wall, like pitch the whole thing. You'll start at midnight and they'll pitch the whole thing. Like if you're fast and you're efficient, then maybe you can pitch these kind of things, but it's sometimes very hard to get like a belay you would actually trust on that kind of thing. You really are just, you know, trusting that you can climb up and down safely. And I think you can usually tell when you're on the angle where you don't feel comfortable. You know, once you start thinking I might fall off here, that's when you need to not be climbing up something like that. That's when you need to like go back down again, because it's okay to think like that when you're doing technical climbing, but not when you're doing this kind of thing. So I would probably recommend to Liam is to stick to the buttresses. Is, you know, instead of doing something like the Swiss route on the courts, like depending on what you've done already, like climbing, if you're Brit and you've been climbing in Scotland and you're doing routes in Scotland, I would like suggest you try more like mixed, you know, mixed routes. Like the first route I did in the Alps was a winter ascent of the Frendo Spur, which was like, you know, horrendous experience. Dropped my boot and everything. I've written all about it, but it was a horrendous experience. But it was very, very safe in retrospect. We always had a belay, you know, we were really, really safe. And then the next route was a northeast spur, the Duats, again in the winter time. And again, we had all sorts of epics. And it was, but it was like safe. We always had belays, and, you know, it was like a really good learning kind of experience. So I guess all the routes I've always done in the Alps, always those kind of routes. And I would say, you know, you can get on these routes, and if you can't do them, then you can always like, you know, wrap off them and stuff. You know, it's kind of harder to wrap off the middle of a huge kind of ice face. And I really feel like these ice face routes are a kind of the climate's, you know, obviously getting, you know, it's obviously like warming. So the winters are not as, you know, they're not building up as well as they used to. So you have to be careful not to end up trying these routes that are not really climbable, like for all the time. Where the past, you could probably climb them, you know, all the winter. Like the weather's, I can remember like when I was doing these routes, like in the 90s, and people like Rab Carrington were telling me that, oh, that wasn't a winter ascent, like the winters in the 70s were much colder than this. So, you know, the weather's been like, the winters have been getting like more milder, you know. But then I think last time I was in the Alps, they had like record amount of snow. It was like Baltically cold. So you never know. Like, I don't really believe, you know, I'm not a climate change skeptic, because the climate is like always changing. And like, when you go, if you travel, like I'm interested in history. If you travel around the world, you go to these places, and you'll read about, you know, like the settlers who first came to places, and you'll just read about the most horrendous, you know, effects of climate on, you know, early settlers to, you know, to Canada or Australia or New Zealand and things. And basically the weather's just, the weather's a really deadly, you know, element. It never stays the same. It's always like changing. So yeah. But as factually, like, you, it's very important to learn how to climb snow or snare if you come from Hull. You do need to kind of do your apprenticeship on snow climbing, because you do end up climbing some routes, you know, where the snow can be really, really steep. Like, you just got like unconsolidated snow that maybe is like 80 degree angle or something, that you can get some really horrendous experiences of snow. Snow and like rime and all the kind of weird, you know, you basically go from ice, you know, like transparent ice, you know, all the way through to this kind of horrible, I think Mark Twight, he calls it like the, you know, like ice inside of a freezer. You know, you get all these like weird kinds of ice and snows. And that is really important to learn how to climb that kind of stuff. It's very important if you're climbing over a Bergstrand to be able to understand how all that kind of shit works. And sometimes you get, you know, sections of climbs where it's like steep and it's covered in snow. So so it's basically understanding what's going to take you where. Like, sometimes you end up just like chimneying up inside the snow, and often you have to use your knees, that you'll pad down the snow underneath you to make it solid, and you'll stand upon that, then you'll do the same thing again, and you're basically building like a platform, but you have no protection whatsoever, so you cannot afford to fall off. So if you're just trusting, you know, so many times it's a bit like scrambling, where you're like, if my knee slips here, I'm going to die, you know, because there's so you do need to be quite good at doing that kind of stuff, like, you know, using your entire arms to like pushing into the snow, and how you can use your ice axes and cam them into the snow, and also often being able to like dig all the way down into the rock, where there's some rock or there's something, you can find some protection in there. So all these, you just got to take your time. You can't really rush that kind of stuff. Like, sometimes you need to have a shovel, like having a shovel's, you know, really, really handy. Just literally to like dig yourself, you know, through this thing. I know like Don Willans, he used like an entrenching tool. Because an entrenching tool, you could have the spade like set at 90 degrees. Is that 90 degrees? Yeah, 90 degrees. You know, so you could use it like a giant adze and stuff. So yeah, and as for protection on snow and snare, then a snow stake is a good piece of gear to actually invest in. Like, if you're climbing these gullies and these easy routes, maybe in the Alps, maybe you'd use one in the Alps. Really, really, really good to get hold of one. Buy like probably MSR, probably make the most common one, and buy one with like a fitted metal strop in the middle, you know, like in the balance point, in the right in the middle of the stake, and you can use it. It makes a very effective like T anchor, where you like make a T and you put it down there, and the cable's coming out, and it makes very. You can use it as a standard, you know, like hammer it in, kind of like a stake, snow stake kind of anchor, and you can do all the really, really, really handy things, and they're super light. And like, learn how to do like a stomper belay. That's a kind of a handy one to know. Learn up the belay, and then see if two of you can pull it out. Like, I had a photograph on my Instagram, and it was from down. It was actually a a Dachstein mitt with a Mars bar inside it, stuffed with snow, which was an anchor, like a Scottish classic, like Scottish winter climbing anchor. And then, because my dad, I think my dad had told me about this kind of anchor, and someone told me the Dachstein mitt. I don't think it had a Mars bar in it. Cut a slot, put the mitt in there, put the rope around it, and he said there was like four of them, and they couldn't get it to come out. So the snow is your friend really, but you just have to know how to handle it really. So I think maybe that's I'm losing my voice now, so I need to go and have another cup of tea. So I shall leave it there. Like I have had like a lot of questions, like tons and tons and tons of questions about. I've got one last question here. I'll answer that. We have had a lot of questions about soloing devices, and I do apologise if I've not replied to them. But this is something I think I'm gonna have to do if I do a video. So if you wanna listen. Something about soloing and soloing devices and that kind of stuff, then I probably need to do it with some visual aids, dig out my silent partner and all that kind of crap. So follow me on YouTube. I think it's like, and just type in Andy Kirkpatrick, you'll find it. Anyway, I'll just answer this last question because it's like, hey Andy, I'm just wondering if you use a Dyneema sling as a prusik third hand when abseiling or hauling. I know there are concerns of a melting and slippiness, but I've heard some people do use that. I thought you'd be the best person to ask since you cut the waffle and go straight for the practical. God, he's probably doesn't know what I'm like these days. So a bit of data for you here. So you've got to separate out Dyneema slings. Separate Dyneema from Kevlar and nylon. So nylon melts at about 250 degrees Celsius. Kevlar melts at 500 degrees Celsius. And Dyneema melts at 145 degrees Celsius. So as you can see, Dyneema melts very, very easily. If you hold a... If you've got a bit of the Kevlar, Dyneema and nylon, you know, as soon as you put the match or any kind of heat near the Dyneema, it kind of like shrivels up immediately. So it's got a low, you know, a very, very low melting point. Is that low melting point? No, low, yeah, melting point. But the question is, like a lot of these things, you get, there's a lot of stuff that people, this is a classic climbing forum question, where you'll get like 50 people saying like, oh, don't do it. Never use a nylon, never use a Dyneema sling. You will die for sure. Blah, blah, blah. Look at this test. Blah, blah, blah. And then you'll get one person who's like a, you know, mountain guide, you know, German, old German mountain guide. Like, I always use Dyneema slings. It has the best. And there'll be, you know, people like, you don't know what you're talking about. So I would, it's all about what you use them for, basically. So I would say the bigger issue for me is that Dyneema is not very grippy. It's like amazingly slippery kind of material. And anybody who like the cohesion ability of the thing is really, really important. Like how much it can deform and grip around something. That's why like I've got like, you know, prusik loops that just don't work. They're just made out of stuff that's just too stiff. They just will not grip to anything. Unless you get exactly the right knot and be really, really careful. Where like a really, really old piece of, 6mm or whatever, 7mm, 5mm, very, very old cord. It's very flexible. It's a bit fared up and everything else. Like, those will like grip, right? Super, super, super well. The default prusik at the moment, or friction hitch, like in the book, I've got rid of, I'm trying to not use the word prusik because there's a lot of prusiks that aren't prusiks, that you don't tie a classic prusik knot. So that confuses some people. And also often it's not a loop either. But probably the best sort of prusik friction hitch loop type thing at the moment is the 6.8 millimeter hollow block ones that Sterling make, Sterling ropes. I think you seem to buy them most places. If you look in tree surgery places, you know, they sell this kind of stuff as well. But it's made out of Kevlar. So first of all, it's got really, it's like incredibly tough. It's like twice as strong as, I think it's like 60% stronger than, it's fucking strong. You're not going to break it. It's like really, really strong. It's made out of Kevlar. So it's very resistant to heat. So it's not going to, you know, wear when you're using it, when you're abseiling as like a third hand and stuff. And it's very, very grippy. Like a hollow block is basically like instead of a rope where you've got the core and the sheath, I think a hollow block is just basically all like sheath. It's like a very thick, you know, hollow tube of Kevlar. And it's sewn together. Like I've got a VT one, which is like a length of Kevlar with two loops on the either end, which is really, really handy. I've also got a loop as well, so I carry like two plus six. And I would highly recommend investing in like a Kevlar sewn together, a prosthetic loop for various reasons. Really, 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 really handy. Much better than like cord is kind of good because you can dispose of it more easily. And you should always remember that you can use, if you've got like a 7mm cordlet, then if you've got double ropes, you can use that on you know, 7mm is probably getting a bit too thick if you've got a really, really skinny rope, but you can use it on double ropes. So if you were setting up a whole system, you've got like two ropes, you can use it for that, and you can use it for various things. So, the question is like if you're in a position where you don't have a prosthetic loop, and you need to use like the two times you're going to use this. Is when you want to have like a backup when you're abseiling, or when you're like you've fallen off and you're hanging in space and you can't get back on, or you just can't climb the pitch. Like I did a route last year where I just could not. I was really, really cold and I just could not do the. I did one of these things where you do like a 6 meter abseil down. It was like in the Blue Mountains in Australia, and it was like Baltically cold. It was in the winter time. Baltically cold. Really, really windy. And we wrapped down to the bottom of this wall and started climbing up. And then the sun went off the crag and it just got absolutely freezing cold. And then Vanessa was like climbing, you know, she was really cold leading a pitch. And I got really cold waiting. And then when it came to lead to second, I just was like so cold. I couldn't feel my hands and I kept falling off. So I had to use a prosthetic loop. But in that case, on that example, I think we had like a 7.1 millimeter. We had two ropes. One was like 7.1, and I had to try and, you know, prosthetic up on this 7.1 millimeter rope. And I had the prosthetic loop, 6.8 millimeter prosthetic loop, and it wouldn't grip for some reason. I just got it to grip on the rope. So if I had like a 5 millimeter standard prosthetic loop, maybe it would have worked. Maybe I just did it wrong, but. Anyway, but that's often the way. I remember climbing in Alaska, and we had like 8.1 millimeter ropes, and Paul Ramsden had one of those plastic ice screw holding devices on his harness, and something happened. I can't remember what happened, but it basically snapped off. It just like ripped off the harness. Even though it was a black diamond harness, it wasn't very well how it was made. It just ripped off, and all the screws fell down the couloir. So we had to go down. I think we tied both the ropes together, and I managed to wrap like 120 meters down there, down to over the Bergschrund. And then I had like two of those rope men, wild country rope men. And then I'll just Jumar all the way back up again. And the rope men would not grip on the rope. They just kept sliding down the rope. So it's like Murphy's Law, like whenever these things happen, you know, shit doesn't work. So it's good to have tried it beforehand. A dynamo sling, you can use a dynamo sling. It will work. Hopefully it will work. The best way to do it. So this is why it'd be good to have a video, but, it's called like an F. If you look up, if you type in like FB Prusik, FB, like for, it's a German guy's name. I can't remember his name now. was it Franz Backman? Franz Backman prussic. And you'll see a few different versions of it, but basically where you've got the stitching on the sling, imagine like a classic French prussic, a classic prussic knot, where you just like, you know, you've got a loop and it goes around the rope, through the loop, around the rope, through the loop, around the rope. So you've got like, you know, six sort of loops with the rope coming out the middle of it. So you kind of do that kind of thing, but where your initial loop is, where the sling is passing through, that's where the stitching is on the sling, and that works pretty well. And I think you do like 1, 2, 3, 4. Is it 4 loops? 4 loops. You can do like 6 loops, but you just do a few loops, and that does tend to work. The other way you can do more of a climb heist, where you just you wrap it around and then you pass. So you have the stitching at the very, very bottom, and then you wrap the sling around the rope going upwards, and then you pass it back down through where the stitching is, and that creates like the capturing kind of loop at the bottom of the prussic. But one thing I use quite a lot, if I'm sort of abseiling and I've forgotten I don't have a prussic to abseil with, I often use like I carry quite a few 30 centimeter quick draws, like open quick draws that you can use for, because a lot of people they make the mistake that all the quick draws are too short. They've all got these like 15 centimeter ones, you know, 10 centimeter ones, which are just not, they're no use whatsoever apart from sport climbing. So all my quick draws are quite long, so they're like 20. They're either 20 or 30 centimeters long, and they're all. The 20 ones are usually like express ones, so they're like sewn together, and the other ones are longer. And the longer ones, because they're open, you can feed them through pegs and you can tie things off with them. They're kind of handy. So, but I always have two like lock draw quick draws, where it's a draw with a small screw at one end and a carabiner on the other end. And they work really well if you have to use it as a prussic. So you just tie an auto block prussic with the sling, clip it back into the, so you got the locker on one end, you know, clip that into your harness, wrap the thing around, clip it back into the locker, and you're away. And although like maybe Dyneema has got a lower ability to grip the rope, it doesn't really matter if you're using it as a third hand below your belay device, because the actual force on the rope is actually very, very low, because the belay device is taking nearly all the force, all the weight, and it's just there as a, you know, it's very, very, you can like hold the rope with your fingers and it'll stop, you know, fingertips. So that's a good thing. So they do work, but you wouldn't want to like go around using a prussic, like a backup made out of a Dyneema sling all the time, because what would happen, it would like rapidly wear out, like, you know, within like, you know, 5 or 6 wraps, it would probably start like seriously degrading how strong it is. And then if that sling ended up being used as like protection and you fell on it, it probably could snap. Because slings are actually not that, slings are very, very strong when they're brand new, but they're not that strong when they're knackered. And that's why you should always replace all your slings fairly, you know, every few years. Because in the past you had these like troll blue super tube slings, which were, you know, they were like probably 40 kilonewtons in strength. They were like, you know, crazy strong. And those things could last you like 20 years. But now you've got slings which are designed to just get in, you know, to the rating. They're not designed to be any stronger than the max, the minimum. So those kind of slings, they got less leeway for them to last. So, yeah. But try it out. You know, don't take my word for it. You know, go to the climbing wall, go to a tree, you know, go in your back garden. If you're getting a rope out, throw it over a tree, make sure that no one thinks you're doing anything else. And yeah, try it out. You might find it doesn't work. So it's at least you know, and I don't. I'm only going by what I think, not what I know. So that's, yeah. Anyway, so that'll be it. I shall go and watch Grand Designs, and like everybody else is probably doing right now. And I shall talk to you soon. Goodbye.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.